one and all, and welcome back to the Cinewalk Hour.
Hello, everyone. It's Dennis Berger here.
And this is Michael Gaughan, and I don't have as much energy as Dennis does. But
No, for me, it's because I'm about to go to sleep. So I'm kicking myself into hyperactive mode. We have horrible pollen here, so my allergies are in overdrive, and I'm taking Benadryl, and I just want to go to bed.
Okay, I think we've got a good enough topic to keep you alert for the next half hour, but let's see. You know, this is, I think, going to be a really important show for us. This is a subject I've been wanting to get to since we first started the podcast. I think this really defines what Cinewalk is all about. And I'm not trying to be coy about it, but what we're going to be talking about is about how home theaters and even media rooms, when done right, can be better than the average movie theater. And done even better can be better than a premium movie theater. I could be wrong, but I don't think a lot of people are really aware that we've reached that point.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people would say, yes, I would rather watch a movie at home for all of the obvious reasons. But yeah, I don't think a lot of people have come to terms with the fact that even in technical respects, yeah, your home can be better than, you know, the local Cineplex.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's what I'm hoping we'll get into, is that we're not just bragging here. We're saying that on a purely technical level, the kind of content you can access, the quality of the content, the kind of playback you can get at home, forget all the subjective elements, it's better than the average movie theater. Movie theaters used to set the standard, and that's just not true anymore.
Yeah. I mean, they used to call it going to a show for a reason, because it was a show. Now it's just something you do to kill 2 hours. So.
Yeah. So the other thing is, we're going to be welcoming Cinelux contributor Andrew Robinson to the podcast for the first time. Andrew and I worked on Theo's Roundtable together. And if you're not familiar with Theo's Roundtable, as opposed to the Raver Roundtable, I'm not at all surprised, because we were kind of a secret society. Even though that wasn't our intention, it just sort of played out that way. But Andrew was just an amazingly versatile contributor, and he's got a lot of real world experience that he can draw on whenever he writes on things. And I think he's a great asset to Cinelux, and I'm glad he's going to be doing the podcast. Dennis, I know you've got a professional relationship with Andrew as well.
Yeah. Andrew was the editor-in-chief of Home Theater Review before, well, right about the time I started working there, but now he's a writer for the site, writes for us there. And his articles and his reviews are always wonderfully provocative. And what I love about Andrew is just, he shoots from the hip. So there are not a lot of people who do that. He says exactly what he thinks and makes no apology.
Yeah, he just did that on Cinelux when he, you know, we got a post up this week about, you know, can the beauty industry save specialty AV? And I don't think he pulled his punches in there at all.
No, he does not. Yeah. He does not pull punches. So.
By the way, you know, I'm obviously chomping at the bit to get to the main topic, but quickly, before we get to that, before we bring John Siaka and Andrew in, I wanted to get to one of Dennis's favorite subjects, which is Critical Role.
Critical Role!
Yes. Yeah, and you know, I want to devote a future podcast to talking about all the radical changes in content creation, because it's astonishing what's going on, and I don't think people have a good sense of what the next 3 to 5 years is going to bring. But I see the Critical Role thing as a harbinger of that. So rather than just have a conversation where Dennis dwells on his private obsession, since it's literally in the headlines at the moment, why don't you just give us an update on what's going on? Sort of for people who don't know, sketch in why this is, I'm not going to say game changer, a redefining moment for home entertainment, which it definitely is.
Yeah. Let me be as brief as I possibly can while having so much to cover, because this is such a huge topic. But basically, Critical Role, as I've mentioned in the podcast before, is a bunch of voice actors who are best friends who get together every week and live stream their weekly Dungeons and Dragons game for the world to watch. And it started off really small, and it built all of this momentum, and it has basically become Mr. Rogers for nerds, right? Except it's this completely wild and improvisational freeform storytelling and gameplay, and it's just amazing. The problem is, you know, I think the establishment looks at that as something as really, really niche. And this is despite the huge...
What are the numbers? You gave me points of comparison with like Walking Dead and
It's really hard to tell. I mean, it's in the millions, definitely. I think the first episode of the second campaign has been viewed something like 3.8 million times on YouTube alone. And the show originally streams on Twitch, so YouTube is its secondary platform for rebroadcasts, almost like, you know, syndication. And it's nearly 4 million people just for that. It's definitely millions of people watching this, but they wanted to make an animated special, sort of telling the stories from their campaign before they started broadcasting it, right? And they went to all of the major studios and everything, and they were like, that sounds really cool, but we don't know what data, how many people are really going to watch this? So they decided to start a Kickstarter and fund one 22-minute episode that was an animated version of one of their early adventures. And they wanted to raise $750,000 to do it right with American-made animation, great animation studio. And they thought, maybe we can get there. And they got there in minutes. At this point now, the campaign stands at nearly $8 million. It is in the top 10. And by the time all is said and done, it stands a very real chance of being one of the top three Kickstarter projects of all time. It probably won't beat Pebble Time, which is the number one, but it's likely to beat the original Pebble smartwatch for crowdfunding. It's already the number one video Kickstarter of all time. It's passed Veronica Mars. It's passed MST3K. And it just goes to show that I don't think the entertainment industry right now really understands their audience at all.
That's what I was going to say, is that's why I'm going to do a whole show about this, because this is content that the mainstream just has no idea how to handle. But it plays into another theme that we want to cultivate on the site, which is people do not appreciate the impact of whatever you want to call it, nerd culture, geek culture, on mass audiences now. We're talking huge numbers, and we're talking about incredibly devoted audiences.
Yeah.
And if you want to merchandise these guys, if you want to exploit these guys, they're just out there for the picking. And studios are clueless.
Right.
And they're all regrouping now, trying to figure. And we've talked about where they're likely to take this and how they're likely to drain, how they don't get why it works, and they're likely to drain all the life out of it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons the show is so popular, and one of the things they want to maintain in their animated series, which I think scares a lot of establishment types, is, you know, this is storytelling based on chaos. It's based on failure. It's based on rolling a dice and getting a one and having to deal with the consequences. So you get this really organic storytelling that's unlike anything you could come up with if two guys sat alone in a room and just wrote a story, right? And they're taking that and turning it into something that looks more traditional, but captures the spirit of that, you know, live gameplay experience. And I think that just terrifies Hollywood. You know,
there is no formula. It's the thing we've talked about, that studios like perfectly repeatable experiences.
Yeah.
They want you to react to what you liked in the original over and over and over and over again. And this does not allow for that. And that's probably why it's so popular.
Oh God, it's a huge part of the reason. But of course, the other part of the reason is just because you can tell that this show is based on love and friendship. And these people that are doing it together, if Critical Role was off the air tomorrow, these people would still be getting together every Thursday night to play their game and tell their stories to each other. You know, they do it out of love. And I think that's why it resonates.
Every episode, they don't draw guns on each other?
No, they love each other. In fact, and the way they end every show is by imploring the people watching, go love your friends, love your family, love each other, be kind to each other, you know? And like I said, it's Mr. Rogers for nerds, but they do drop the occasional F-bomb, but you know what I mean? It's they're building a genuine sense of community, which is really hard to do in a manufactured way. But I think the bigger story here is just, man, don't underestimate the appeal of things that you think are niche, because niche is the new normal. So
if it's compelling, and you know, if we start fetishizing that, then this whole thing is going to go awry, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. I think it's genuinely unexplored territory. And I think what's odd for people is people think of this as YouTube, low res or whatever. Yes, that's where the origins were. But this is going to be more and more something you're going to want to experience in your home theater, your media room, on your best possible setup, because it'll make it that much more engrossing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, my wife and I, we watch every week on a, you know, 75-inch 4K display, just because, you know, part of the compelling part of the is just seeing the actors' faces and everything and seeing them interact. And, you know, they've got their own studio now, whereas they used to play around a, you know, kitchen table. So it's become pretty high production, but that's not really the point. The point is the sincerity and the genuine love with which they're creating it. And I think that's why it resonates. It's hard to capture in a bottle.
Yeah. So. Hey, Dennis, this is coming dangerously close to becoming the entire episode. We've got John and Andrew waiting, and I think this is a great topic, but it is one for another day. And let's get to the main attraction. So we're going to take the shortest of breaks, and we'll be back on the other side with Andrew Robinson and John Siaka. See you then. Okay, we're back from break, and we're joined by John Siaka, and for the first time by Andrew Robinson. John and Andrew are both contributors to the site, but this is the first time Andrew's been on the podcast. So Andrew wears many hats, so I thought he could briefly talk to us about his background before we get into the discussion.
Sure. thank you. I started out in entertainment advertising, making movie posters and trailers for Warner Brothers and, you know, the like, and kind of parlayed that into being able to actually make a couple of films, one of which ended up at Warner Brothers. And then I did some work with Hulu, and we've done some documentaries in conjunction with CNN. And then I sort of left all that after 12 years, and I've been kind of freelancing, doing my own thing as a videographer, and just, I believe in new media. I believe in the democratization of entertainment. And so it behooves me to not serve a single master. So I am very flexible. And even in the last year or so, I've partnered with my fiance and have even managed to start shooting weddings at a very high level, which is a whole new realm of cinematography and things like that. But for the most part,
braver than I thought, man.
Yeah, for the most part, I'm kind of a hired gun when it comes to either consulting on branding. I create a lot of commercial branding for companies in the specialty AV space and beyond. I have pro audio clients as well, and then I just kind of do my own video thing, even on YouTube myself, to learn and educate others and kind of see where this whole ecosystem is going.
Okay. Yeah. I did want to start with a digression, but you know, you did pick up on Dennis's recent post about Critical Role in your post that went up today. Just want to see if you guys wanted to talk for a minute about this sort of new wave in content creation. It seems to dovetail with what you're doing.
Well, I think that for me, you know, I've written for AV publications for almost 20 years now, and I started beating the drum of the death of the written word as it relates to hobbyist or enthusiast publications. I don't think that I don't think like the New York Times is going to fail anytime soon, but I do think that there are publications out there that it's a very, very narrow niche, and that niche is shrinking because the audience that they continue to go after is not the audience that will sustain them. And that audience has moved on to video. That audience has moved on to influencers. And so for me, the whole onus of the article that I wrote today was spurred on by Dennis's article, where he kind of looked at how niche entertainment has become mainstream. And I would make the argument that it's not only mainstream, it's how actually the bulk of people are consuming media. And it's really funny when you look at like news shows, for example. I know this isn't home entertainment, but like news shows, an example where you can have a top rated newscaster on any channel. It doesn't matter which channel it is. And they're talking about 2 to 4, you know, or 5 million viewers at the 7 o'clock hour. Yet you have 15-year-olds that will do double that inside of 2 hours on YouTube on a random Tuesday because they felt like it.
Yeah.
And that really is an amazing thing and a scary thing for the establishment, because there are powers and forces that be that connect with the younger audience that, just bringing it back to AV, they need to connect with in a very meaningful way. And they're not doing it because they don't think that young people value quality or anything. They think they're all about their smartphones and convenience. And this simply just isn't true. I mean,
isn't part of the counter argument vinyl? I mean, that's a whole other thing that we don't need to get into right now, but you can't really say the younger audience doesn't appreciate quality if it worships the vinyl ritual as deeply as it does.
Hey, I'll tell you one thing. I was goofing around on YouTube on my channel, and I'll admit I am nowhere near influencer level, but I screwed around and made a fun vinyl video with my fiance where we started off by poking fun at vinyl, and then I brought it back around to why I happen to be a vinyl enthusiast, because I am. And we've done almost 1 million views on that video. and the monetization of that video is incredible when you stop and think about, oh my God, like my channel reaches a very, very small group. Had I been someone with 1 million, 2 million followers, how big that message would have been. And to see the subscriber jumps, to see the interaction, I'm sorry, I've written for websites, like I said, for 20 years. The level of communication, the level of dialogue, the level of everything that has come out of that video in less than a month, any publication would kill for in 2019.
Yeah.
And we did it on a lark.
This is definitely a subject I want to do another episode about. Dennis and I talk about it all the time, and there's all kinds of examples we can refer to. There's a lot of unexplored territory out there.
Right.
But I can't wait to see people embrace.
It's important to understand, though, like, and this is, I mentioned this in the article, it's not that the community is shrinking. I thought it was. It's not. The AV community is just not in forums and blogs anymore. It is in podcasting. It is in videos. It is in enriched live shows, you know, Instagram live. It's there. There are so many people that want to buy this stuff, and no one is speaking to them. No one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like I said, let's pick up the ball another day on this, because I really want to dig into it, but I want to segue. I want to use your comment about the democratization of technology and media to segue into talking about today's topic, which is, I want to throw the premise out there that home theaters, when done right, and when you take all the various factors into account, have now reached a point where they can exceed the performance and the experience of an average movie theater. Does everybody agree with that?
Yeah, I think I think the important question is, like, when did we pass that threshold? Not have we passed it, when did we pass it? Because at this point, I think it's undeniably true.
Well, I think you have to underline, though, a key differentiator in your question, which is when done right. There are a number of people out there that have all of the nicest stuff that is not done right, in which case I would say no. But yes, in capable hands, when done correctly, I agree with Dennis. It has, and it only will, with one caveat. And the caveat is compression, because compression is the linchpin for which home entertainment hinges on. And it's simply not necessarily as big of a thing in the commercial cinema space.
The one counterpoint that I would make to that, though, you drove home the very important point of when done right. Honestly, I think that's almost a bigger consideration in commercial cinemas. You know, my wife and I made a rare trip to the cinema last weekend to see Captain Marvel. And as soon as the trailer started, I knew something wasn't right. And I went out and spoke to someone working in the theater. I was like, look, your levels in the IMAX screen are down 6 dB. It's 6 decibels too quiet. And deer in headlights. And I was like, can I speak to the manager, please? And he was like, I am the manager. And it was like, okay, I just need you to turn the volume up in the IMAX screen 6 decibels. And he looked at me and blinked and said, what is a decibel? You know? It's really hard for me to find a commercial cinema experience that's done right. So,
well, but what you're talking about there is something that also plagues the home cinema markets, and that is just a level of automation. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to be a theater projectionist, and I wound 35 millimeter film and spliced it, and I had to know those types of things. Nowadays, films, even at the theatrical level, are beamed to the theater in much the same way that we're used to beaming content or streaming content from Netflix. It is beamed to a hard drive, or a hard drive is slipped in, and literally they don't even have projection booths anymore. I mean, there are physical booths where projectors reside, but they're hitting go, stop and go from a keyboard at a kiosk in like the office. They're not mm-hmm. going up there anymore.
Yeah.
And that's the level of automation that makes this thing possible for them and allows for bigger theaters, more showings and things like that. But conversely, when it comes to super high-end home theaters, you have the same level of automation where, yes, it's great for, I'm going to throw you a bone, John, it's great for installers like yourself and dealers and whatnot. But at the same time, if something is awry, I would argue that some of these clients with these super nice home theaters don't know how to change plus or minus 6 dB either. So it's a wash in my opinion.
John, can you speak to that? What's your experience with clients and their level of understanding of their own systems?
Very low, but that's one of the nice things about home is you can make it as loud or as quiet as you want. And I think most people adjust the volume to where they feel like it sounds good to them, as opposed to, you know, putting it at reference level or whatever. I think it's one of the things people like about it is you can adjust it if it's too loud for you or too quiet. And, you know, kind of speaking to your experience that you had with Captain Marvel, I had a friend who worked at the IMAX theater here, and, you know, he took me through the booth one time, and while I was up there, they got a call. Someone complained that it was too loud, and so they turned it down. And it's like, you know, in the commercial space, one voice can ruin it for everybody. And that's one of the things that, you know, about a home theater, that you watch it on your schedule, you watch it, you know, the way you want to. But as far as mm-hmm. customer understanding, I mean, they know how to hit, you know, watch, you know, Blu-ray, watch Kaleidoscape, you know, watch Apple TV, scroll to the content they want to see, hit play, and then volume up, volume down. Most of them would have no idea about a reference level or any of that. They just put it where it sounds good to them and sit back and enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think one of the other things that we should dig into is just the experience itself, because for me in my lifetime, and granted I am elderly, but you know, in my lifetime, the experience of going to the movie theater has become so diminished. You know, when I was a kid, it was the most special thing in the world. And now it's just, you know, it's sticky floors and you know, projector bulbs that should have been changed 6 months ago, and cardboard covered in yellow grease that they're selling as popcorn, you know, whereas at home, my wife and I are big gourmet popcorn fans, and we can have the delicious popcorn and everything like that. And, you know, getting back to the point of automation, we've got this experience dialed in to where it's not when we turn on the system that the lights come down, it's when we start watching a movie that the lights come down. And when you factor in other things like shades and so forth, I think the very experience of itself at home can honestly be more special than sort of the cattle yard experience of going to the movies these days.
Well, I'll say another thing too. I mean, it definitely depends on where you live. You know, I live in Myrtle Beach, which is not a small city, but we do not have any luxury theaters here. There's not a theater within 100 miles of me. I think it's not within 300 miles of me that has Dolby Atmos. There's no Dolby Cinemas. So I can get a way better experience in my house than anything I could go and see here. I mean, with the trade-off of, you know, it's a bigger screen at the commercial cinema.
Yeah.
But if I had the access to a Dolby Cinema or one of the new Sony digital cinemas that they're building, I think I would be more inspired to go out and see a movie, because that goes back to that ultra special experience where you're getting a premium experience that you couldn't replicate at home short of spending, you know, $500,000. But I think the theaters, and this is something that I wrote about for the site not too long ago, commercial theaters are being forced to raise their game because the home market has gotten so good at such an affordable price. We finished an install on Friday for a customer. The whole job ended up being under $30,000. And it's a 4K Sony projector, 11-channel audio system, two subs, automation. And when we were done, it's like they were just blown away. Yeah. So, you know, that's probably another family that the commercial cinema lost.
Yeah. Andrew, I think you have the benefit of living in a slightly more cosmopolitan market than either John or I do. I'm lucky to have, you know, two sort of flagship screens here in Montgomery. We've got a Big D and we've got an IMAX, but what's the scene like for you? I mean, are there any premium cinemas around you?
Well, yeah, I think there are quite a few. I actually define premium differently than you and John. I could care less, honestly, if a theater had Atmos or not.
Neither.
I had not gone to the movies in probably 5 or 6 years. And when I moved to Austin, I started going again because we have the Alamo Draft House.
Yeah.
And that is an experience, whether you're going to a small one or their flagship one, in the sense, because it's, you know, it's assigned seating. The seating is always comfortable. The food is amazing. And they take the audience, you know, silence, things like cell phones and distractions very seriously. They may not always have the greatest sound system or whatever, but it's the fact that everyone that goes there to watch a movie.
Yeah.
And when you have an environment like that, where there's 200 to 400 people in an audience and they know the reason they're there is to watch a movie and not kill time because it's really hot outside, because that's what you do at like an AMC.
Yeah.
And you'll see people on their phones. I mean, Alamo Drafthouse will straight up kick you out if they see a blue screen dim in the light, or, you know, in the darkness. They will just, no ands, ifs, or buts about it. You're gone. And that to me is worth more than all of the abbreviations of some tech that is out there. And that's why I've gone back to the theater. But I do want to say this. I think on many levels, you know, home cinema is winning out too, not necessarily because the technology and the experience at home is better. For a lot of families, I mean, for me, it's just, you know, me and my fiance. But if we were a family of 4 or 5, going to the movies gets really expensive really fast.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, I've got a 12-year-old and a 3-year-old, and it's not even the money. For us, it's the logistics of it.
Yeah.
My wife really wants to see Captain Marvel. So now it's okay, we've got to line up a sitter. How long can we be gone? What, you know, it's like, right. It becomes this whole thing where normally we want to watch a movie, you know, we put the 12-year-old to bed and we fire up the theater at 10 o'clock if that's what we want to do. And so the logistics are what make a home theater so appealing to a lot of people.
So you're winning. But what the argument you're making there is actually, yes, you do happen to have the quality as well, John, but it's the convenience that's winning out for you. And that's the argument that in specialty AV, no one wants to admit, and that is, there's convenience at every level. And it's not just like streaming or, you know, oh, Netflix is really convenient, but the quality is crap. No, it's convenience at every level. And I will argue too, the whole big screen experience, short of an IMAX with stadium seating and a proper, short of an IMAX screen with an appropriate angle of view with stadium seating, Can we kind of agree about the perceived size of a movie theater screen versus the size of your home? Like, yeah. this myth that I have a projection screen or I have a big cinema screen and therefore I'm so much more immersed than my 75-inch, that is 75-inch flat screen, that is all relative to where you sit.
Yeah, we sit about 6.5 feet away from our display. And I know when I got this 75-inch TV in for review, the first thing my wife and I did was watch Star Wars, because, you know, that's what you do with a new TV. That's how you christen it. Honestly, when the closing credits rolled, my wife looked at me and said, F IMAX. It was as immersive as anything you could ever ask for.
So. Yeah, and I defy anybody on this podcast to go on a blog or whoever we write for respectively and say that a 75-80-inch TV can be as immersive as a 120-inch projection screen or a cinema theater screen. You will get crucified.
Yeah.
You will absolutely get crucified despite speaking truth to the situation.
Okay, let's take a little break, and when we come back, I'd like to regroup a little, because I think I just realized that the deciding factor in all this might not really be the tech, but we'll be right back. To sum up where we've been, it occurred to me while everybody's been talking about this, but once you have good enough equipment, I think the deciding factor is comfort. And comfort is subjective. It means different things to different people, but it means being able to tweak the experience in a way you can never do in a movie theater.
True.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think I will say this, the one downside to being at home that we run into repeatedly is we fall asleep.
Yeah.
You know, the theater chairs at Alamo are fantastic. We love them to death. I've never fallen asleep in them, despite them being comfortable. But you get me on this sofa sitting at just the right angle, I'm game on for a movie. And then 20 minutes later, I don't know what happened.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So there is comfort to a degree, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay. The point I wanted to make, and because the orthodoxy has always been you must have a dedicated home theater room if you want to achieve the level we're talking about. But I think in the past couple of years, we've gone over the Rubicon, where now what are terribly called media room spaces can also qualify for that. Lighting control and acoustic treatments allow you to get these room spaces to the performance level you couldn't do before. And they're more flexible because they allow for gaming and music listening and things that dedicated rooms just can't accommodate. Has that been true in your experience? I know that that's how John approaches this.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's just a matter of, it boils down to one thing, minimizing distractions. It's when I turn my system on, I want my focus to be on my system. And that does mean making certain compromises in terms of the layout of furniture or decorations or what have you. I'm not going to put, you know, a painting right over my TV, whereas my wife might like something there. Once you get beyond that, it's once I fire my system up, I want that to be the point of view. And I don't think you need a completely enclosed room to do that. When you've got things like lighting and shade control and so forth, you can transform a multi-use space into a system that will hold your attention and minimize distractions. And that's what's important to me.
But does a media room in some way inherently compromise a system so you can say that it's not better than a movie theater, an average movie theater?
I don't think so.
I think the only thing that it's problematic with is sound control. It's tough in an open space, and not even for us, it's not the other sounds of the house coming in. It's the sounds of that room going out. Mm-hmm. And it's all but impossible to sound treat, you know, a room that's open. I think the biggest challenge of having an open space is that the whole house is going to hear it if you're watching it at any kind of volume level. And, you know, that's just the unfortunate reality of having a loud sound in a big open spot.
But that doesn't necessarily compromise the quality of that sound, does it?
No, it doesn't. It compromises the quality of my 12-year-old sleep, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think though, too, like, with respect to media rooms, the whole purpose of cinema is to be enjoyed by an audience. And I argue that whatever gets people to watch en masse is the better technology, is the better format, is the better environment. So if it's easier for 4 or 5, 6 people at a dinner party to be in the living room with the 90-inch flat screen TV and a great surround sound, you know, 5.1 or 7.1 in ceiling surround sound system on an L or U-shaped sofa, that's the better theater than trying to convince those same 7 or 8 people to shoehorn themselves into a dark room with only one entry point and exit point that may never get used.
Well, I'll tell you exactly, Andrew. I've been doing this for over 20 years, and what I find is the people that build the upstairs dedicated room that you've got to take a trek to, they use the system hardly as often as the people who have it more accessible. It's easy to transition from casual watching or after dinner to just, hey, we're in here, let's watch a movie, as opposed to, okay, everybody up, let's go and move. And, you know, the value of something goes so high up the more that you use it and enjoy it. And so I would agree with that 100%.
Yeah. I mean, I've had dedicated theater rooms in every home that I've lived in, save the one I'm in right now. And I will never do it again. Because even when I built them with my own blood, sweat, and tears and budget, and I had that pride of ownership of, I'm the one that physically built this room. You know, it just, I never used it. I never used my own theaters. I always was down in my own living room in front of a 55-inch flat screen.
Okay, we need to wrap this up, but I just want to see if anybody had any closing thoughts about what all this means for the near future.
Yeah. I would say in the past years that, again, that I've been doing this professionally from the install side, what you can get now for $20,000 or under, it is pretty stunning. And that's generally about the number that we like people to start at when talking about a projection system. When, if you're looking at about a front, you know, like a direct view 75 or 85 inch TV, that number could be, you know, 10 to 15, depending on what you want to do. But even that would be so much more impressive than what most people have experienced. If people haven't considered it, because they think it's too expensive, they really should, you know, go out and take a listen.
Yeah, Andrew, what do you think the entry price is for a movie theater quality setup?
I can tell you right now, it's, for me, it's well under $6,000. And it involves 2.1 and the biggest screen I can afford. And I'll tell you what, when the lights go down, I have a cinema quality experience in my book, but I can say, I think it is possible to even have discrete 7.2 audio with whether you want projection or you don't. I happen to be very anti-projection at the moment. But you know, an 85 inch and 7.2 and a receiver can run you less than $5,000. And if set up properly,
yeah,
and the core physics and basics adhered to, I see no reason why someone can't say that that's better than a commercial cinema experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Dennis, any thoughts?
I think John and Andrew really covered the base as well. I lean a little more toward Andrew in terms of budget, but I think they've got their finger right on it.
So. Okay. Let's take a break and then we'll come back and try to wrap this up quickly. Okay. Be back in a moment. Okay, we're back from break, and I just wanted to wrap this up really quickly by doing something similar to what we did in the last episode. And I just wanted to sort of check in with everybody's experienced in the past week. What have you seen, listened to, or whatever that seemed worthwhile? I know Dennis just reviewed They Shall Not Grow Old for the site and was really impressed by that. I don't know if we should start with that or not. Dennis, do you want to go there?
Yeah, I think we should. I think it's a really important film, and I think maybe a lot of people are going to miss it because the home video distribution seems to be as limited as the theatrical distribution was. For some reason, right now it's only available on Vudu, YouTube, Google Play, iTunes, and Kaleidoscape. That's it. No Amazon, nothing else. But it's Peter Jackson's new film in which he took, you know, tons of footage from World War I and cleaned it up, you know, fixed a lot of the damage, but more importantly, in my opinion, most importantly, in my opinion, took and time corrected it. So all of this footage was shot silently, hand cranked, variable between, you know, 12 and 16 frames a second. And he used his, you know, the massive computer power at his disposal to convert all of that into 24 frames a second with frame interpolation. So all of the people move more naturally. And then he also colorized it. And the effect that it has is, for me at least, it made World War One real in a way that it just never has before for me. And it made the men who fought that war real. I think it's a beautiful, moving film. And I think, and I don't say this often, but I think it's an important film that everybody should check out.
Has anybody else seen it yet?
I've seen the trailer, and I had the same feeling from the trailer that Dennis had, that you connected with, these are now real people. And I'm a huge Peter Jackson fan, even after Mortal Engines, and what he did with this is, it looks stunning. So it's on my list, but we have yet to see it.
Okay. John, anything you've come across in the past week or so?
We watched Aquaman, which is a beautiful, but not moving or important film. it looked great though. And, you know, a lot of it has IMAX footage, and the underwater scenes look fantastic. And Jason Momoa is Momoa-y. And it was entertaining. I'll give it that, but a little long. And kind of like Andrew said, my wife did fall asleep in that one. And we started some Netflix movie starring Keanu Reeves, which is about some kind of eating disorder or something. So it's too early to weigh in on that one yet.
Hey, I want to bring something up real quick. So I was talking to a friend of mine about this. His wife, when they go to an action movie, starts to fall asleep anytime a fight sequence starts. And I've found I have a similar reaction. I was watching a Pirates of the Caribbean movie, and this big fight scene with cannons and clipper ships started and everything, and I started to nod off. Some of us seem to be wired to have that reaction to action scenes. I wonder if anybody else has ever come across that.
It's not that you're wired to have that reaction. It's the fact that you've seen it all before, and they get to be a bit laborious. Like the worst part of like Black Panther for me was the Lexus sponsored car chase that went on entirely too long, right in the middle of that, between the kind of the midway through the second act. And I
think that was Civil War, not Black Panther.
No,
you're right. You're
exactly.
right.
Exactly. It was so long and so bad. You clocked it.
You're right.
You cut that scene out of the film. The film doesn't change. It still makes $1 billion, and it is 22 minutes shorter. And when these comic book movies are running into 3 hour long run times, do we need another action set piece? And I argue that we don't. And speaking of wanting an action set piece, Christy and I watched Triple Frontier on Netflix last night, the new Ben Affleck, movie on Netflix that is produced by, what's her name? Anyway, I don't want to belabor it. Talk about a film that has a great premise and a very, very nice character-driven opening 20, 30 minutes that by the midway through closing end of the second act, you could care less about. Like,
interesting.
I'm dead serious. I went into that film, the opening 30 minutes, I was like, oh my God, Netflix has done it. They've ported over an action film and added a little bit of, you know, story and character development, which they're known for in their episodic stuff. They've managed to do it, and then it just completely falls apart.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah.
Have you seen anything you liked though? Anything good we should check out?
I watch so much YouTube now.
Yeah.
I have to admit, one of the more entertaining bits of television, and I do refer to it as television, that I've seen recently, the very famous YouTuber Shane Dawson recently came out with part one and two of a conspiracy theories show, and they were 90 minute episodes. So we're talking about 3 hours in total, but they were broken into vignettes, and his vignette asking the question about whether or not Chuck E. Cheese recycles their pizza was actually gripping.
wait. Tell me again the title of this, because I have to watch this in between episodes of Critical Role.
Yeah, so. It's Shane Dawson's Conspiracy Theories Part 1 and 2. And Part 2, I think it was, dove into its intercut with, does Chuck E. Cheese recycle their pizza and sell it back to consumers? And in its intercut with a story about a friend of his that may have been attempted to be human trafficked. So it's like, what? You've got this kind of like tongue in cheek, like, is this for real? And then you've got like this human trafficking story all being told, you know, in a very real way, because, you know, Shane is a vlogger. He's not a polished filmmaker. And yeah. I argue, though, that that's part of his charm and why every time he opens his mouth, literally Twitter comes to a grinding halt. and so that was actually very shockingly compelling.
I have to check it out.
It doesn't.
I am putting that in my watch list now.
Yeah, it's not going to win any Dolby Awards, or you don't need a 4K display to make it look good. In fact, I argue you should probably find the only 720p TV left in existence to watch it. but it was entertaining. It was very entertaining. Other than that, we are starting the documentary on The Missing Girl, the Netflix one, the English family whose daughter disappeared. And
Missy Andrescu, Melissa Andrescu, former guest on the podcast. She was recommending that to me as well.
We started watching that. That's really gripping. And I'm halfway through Love, Death, and Robots, which is amazing. Just
so good.
Kick all the children out. That there needs to be way more warnings in front of that show.
But like, how did that, I'm like I said, very old. So for me, what that series is really evoking is heavy metal, but I'm wondering how they got away with like not calling it heavy metal 2019 or whatever. Do you get that sense from it too?
A little bit. I mean, I see Ghost in the Shell. I see Ninja Scroll all over that. I love it. I love it. It reminds me, it's like the X-rated version of like Pixar shorts. and it's, the animation that David Fincher and his team and all the creators did on that, it's pushing the boundaries of blending. Not just, I don't even want to say like photorealism, because the one thing I think that one of the most important movies of last year taught us, or maybe it was this year, Into the Spider-Verse, is that no longer do films have to look a certain way to be legitimately quote unquote films. Love, Death, and Robots kind of has that going for it too, where it's like, these are all very, very important tropes. These are all very important themes. And so some of it's cartoony, some of it's not. And it's just, I just love where we're going in terms of the visual medium and how it's all starting to just blend together into this hyper real reality. When that also maybe is another topic for another time, but I also think that's why ultimately home cinema and commercial cinema will not involve screens at all. But that's all I'm going to
say. Yeah, let's definitely pick up that ball another time. I want to go there, but we have to wrap this one up. John, any closing thoughts?
I also saw the Spider-Verse movie and thought it was fantastic. My daughter, she comes just, it looks amazing. This is so cool. So yes, I think that really, hopefully that will impact future animated movies in a positive way.
Okay. Dennis, anything?
I'm ready to go eat supper.
Oh, okay. Stomach's grumbling?
Yeah.
Okay. On that note, thank you, everybody. I really enjoyed this. And I definitely want to come back very soon and talk about the radical changes in content creation. I think that's a great subject for us to jump into.
Okay.
Everybody game?
I am.
Yeah, Matt.
Okay. So good night, and we'll see everybody in about a week.